I'm Marcus Smith, and this is Constant Wonder. During the summer, I went out in the backcountry with my boy and several other fathers with their sons belonging to a church group. And while we were there, one of the dads suffered an ankle injury. As it happened, he was able to walk out of the woods. It was just 2 miles. He did this on his own. And later at the hospital, scans would show a broken ankle. But in that very same mountainous area, far from civilization, a place called the Uinta Mountains, less fortunate stories have played out in the past, sometimes with fatalities, though I'm glad to say not all that often. But what strikes me today is that in the same wilderness area several decades ago, say in the early 1800s, fur trappers and mountain men had no recourse of any kind in the event of severe injury, or even just if they were to lose their bearings and get lost out there. Today, it's very different. There are helpers. Even my friend with a broken ankle could have leaned on the rest of us in the group to help get him out. Well, we're going to have a visit now with Kevin Grange, a firefighter and paramedic working with Jackson Hole Fire and Emergency Medical Services, also with Grand Teton National Park, also with a book out titled Wild Rescues, A Paramedic's Extreme Adventures in Yosemite, Yellowstone, and Grand Teton. Kevin Grange, welcome to our show.
Thanks, Marcus. Can't wait to speak with you.
You know, Kevin, we are going to talk about some dangerous things that have happened, some trauma, some tragedy even. But before we do that, you also have some lighthearted things to talk about. Can we start on kind of the bright side, the things that make you smile? Because in the national park, and you've been in more than one, sometimes people come with some strange expectations.
Yeah, they do. But, you know, I love just sharing the park with them. And I guess some of the things that makes me smile is just some of the questions that you hear, you know, such as when do the deer turn into elk, or, you know, where's the switch to turn on Old Faithful? Here in the Tetons, they'll ask, you know, does the scenic float end where it begins? And, you know, I'll kind of joke and like, hey, we're not a water park. It's actually a river. So it's kind of point to point. But so we often have, you know, laughter and about those types of questions, but it's also like a great opportunity to kind of educate and, you know, inform the visitor, because we live out here in the mountains, but it's really foreign to a lot of people who've maybe never been to a national park or who live in a city.
You have been so diplomatic. I just have to hand it to you, because I like to laugh at the expense of other people sometimes, actually. You know,
sure.
The idea that people are really kind of sheltered and, well, I guess the sad thing there is that people are so urban these days that when they go to a national park, they're way out of their element.
They are. And then, you know, there's probably a whole subset of funny stories that have to do with the iPhone selfie, you know, people getting too close to a bison, or, you know, maybe wandering off the trail, trying to get that picture near a waterfall. You know, people will try to pet the bison. And again, it's like you say, I think sometimes people just see wildlife in the outdoors on, you know, like a Disney movie or something. And so there's sort of that like Disneyification of the animals that, hey, they're friendly, but, you know, they're definitely wild.
As you're saying this, it just occurs to me that I'm just going to take a guess here that in a place like Yellowstone, in a place like the Grand Tetons, I'm guessing the bulk of the problems do come up with people getting too close to the wildlife.
It is, yeah, definitely a huge problem. And I think prior to working in the Park Service, you know, I thought I had to protect the two-legged animal, humans, from the four-legged ones. But having worked there a while, I realized it's almost like reverse, that we have to protect the four-legged animals from the humans. And, you know, everyone's very well-intentioned, but yeah, they will get as close to the grizzly bear as you let them, or as close to the bison. I think one time we had a parent who wanted to give her child a ride on a bison, you know, and these are animals that weigh a couple tons with sharp horns. So we're very vigilant to sort of make sure people keep a large distance between them and the animals.
Did you ever think you'd be in a place like this?
I didn't. Prior to working for the Park Service, I never even knew there were paramedics in our national parks. And then one winter day, I was in Yosemite and we saw an ambulance drive by and a huge light went off for me. And I was like, this seems amazing and a great opportunity to blend my two passions, which are the outdoors and medicine. So I'm very thankful that I found my way into this, you know, working in the national parks and in the wilderness environment.
So how many national parks are you familiar with, specifically as a professional paramedic?
I've worked in three, Grand Teton, Yellowstone, and Yosemite. And then I've probably visited about 20 others. The nice thing is there's so many. There's actually 410 park units. You know, some might just kind of be a historical building or historical seashore. And then you have like the larger national parks like Zion and, you know, Olympic, Mount Rainier. So really you can spend your life exploring all the national park units and probably never get to all of them.
Yeah. So your story does not begin then with any understanding that there would be paramedics. You just said that you didn't know that there were paramedics affiliated with national parks. And you began in the big city getting involved with what kind of medicine do we call this? There's some technical term for the medicine that happens before you're in the hospital.
Yeah, we call it a pre-hospital medicine. And I studied at UCLA in Los Angeles and then was hoping to work, you know, in Los Angeles or, you know, another city like Seattle. And the hiring curve for firefighters and paramedics, it's really tough. With Los Angeles Fire Department, I think we had 10,000 applicants for an initial recruit class of 70 firefighters. And then, you know, the next time was like 5,000 candidates. So I was kind of like, you know, going up against, I just wasn't getting hired there. And then as I heard about the Park Service, you know, my kind of drive switched to wanting to work in the wilderness kind of environment. So lucky enough, I was able to get hired by the Park Service.
Are the people who work in pre-hospital medicine all physically fit enough to handle the backcountry?
We are. And the cool thing these days is there's that really emphasis on staying healthy, eating healthy, getting enough sleep. And I love the term that we're rescue athletes. And so there's a couple of funny scenes early on in Yosemite when I was on my first search and rescues and I was out of shape there and arriving at my patients more short of breath than they were. And so I realized, hey, I got to get in shape because, you know, it's probably not going to, you know, give a lot of confidence to these patients if the paramedic shows up and he's out of breath and sweating and, you know, needs to take a break before he starts delivering care.
Are you exaggerating that one bit?
Well, the first couple, not really, because, you know, Yosemite Valley, all the trails rise out of the valley. So they're all pretty steep, you know, going up to Yosemite Falls. And, you know, I never had to wait a few minutes. I always kind of got the call rolling and started providing care, but I was definitely out of breath on some of those early calls.
Yeah. Now, you don't get to do any kind of stopping at the scenic outlooks when you're on. How do you marry this whole business if you're a rescuer, but you're in this gorgeous backcountry? Do you just bracket that off and not even really think about the beauty of the place? I mean, it's kind of a silly question to ask, but I would be distracted.
Yeah, definitely. When you're running the call or the search and rescue, you have sort of tunnel vision on your patient. And the unique challenge with pre-hospital medicine and like the wilderness environment is you have the challenge of treating the patient, but then you have your whole extraction and extrication plan of how do you get them to definitive care? Are you going to wheel them out on a wheel litter or call a helicopter or do a fixed wing ambulance? So I love this idea that, you know, transportation is a treatment when you're in the backcountry, you know, almost as important as stopping the bleeding or getting them on oxygen.
Are you hands-on then in both aspects, treating the wounds and putting on the splint or getting the stretcher, but you're also just as involved in arranging the transportation?
We are, definitely. And what I learned early on was if I'm the patient care provider, you know, my job is just to zero in on that patient, but I can also delegate the extraction plan to someone else on my crew. And so their job is to maybe communicate with the helicopter and dispatch. And so we sort of delegate roles so everyone has a job to do. And because there are so many elements that it's too hard for one person to take care of all of them.
So play with me for just a moment here, this mind game of mine where I'm imagining myself in need of a helicopter transport. and I probably got some kind of, you know, I don't know, maybe not in shock completely, maybe still conscious. That helicopter ride is going to scare me.
It will, yeah. You know, it might not as much as you think, because, you know, sometimes when people are in distress due to like a traumatic injury or chest pain, you know, they're in a lot of distress. And so they know they need to get to the hospital. And, you know, they might have previously been afraid of helicopters, but I think at the time they're just like, yes, get me to the hospital. Now, having said that, you know, we did have a Vietnam veteran who boarded the helicopter. You know, he was having chest pain and he'd had 7 heart attacks previously. And he had a sort of Vietnam flashback right as the helicopter went to lift out of Old Faithful. So that's super dangerous just because the patient, there's no barrier between the patient and the pilot. And so if you have a combative patient, you know, it's not good. So they quickly landed and we were able to take them to the hospital just in the ground ambulance. You know, it wasn't the fastest route, but it was the safest and ultimately, you know, what the patient wanted.
What the patient wants. Tell us another story of what the patient wanted, but you thought that's not best for the patient, what the patient wanted.
Definitely. The stories that quickly come to mind is we have a lot of these bus tours. And so people wait years, sometimes their whole life to visit, you know, our natural wonders of Yellowstone, Yosemite, Zion. You know, Utah has 5 great national parks. And then they might, you know, they stop taking their meds because they're on the bus tour and maybe they don't want to have to go to the bathroom because they're taking that diuretic. So a lot of times when people are on vacation, they take a vacation from everything, from their medications, maybe from drinking water. So they end up in these, you know, remote areas and everything sort of catches up with them, the lack of sleep. And then we'll start to get calls for chest pain, shortness of breath at, you know, 2, 3 a.m., and so the challenge there is if we take them to the hospital, that bus tour is over. You know, they can't get back on. And so many times the patient would not want to go to the hospital, and because to them it was sort of the end of the dream. And we would just have to, you know, talk them through it that, hey, these parks are here. They'll be here next year. And right now the most important thing is for you to go to the hospital. And ultimately they'd come to understand.
Yeah, you in your line of work have to have a good bedside manner and you have to do a little bit of kind of emotional therapy for people.
Definitely. And one main difference between urban EMS or urban pre-hospital medicine and, you know, remote and rural EMS is the transport time. So in a city, oftentimes you're with the patient for 5 or 10 minutes, whereas out here and in many parts of the country, you're with the patient for, you know, 45 minutes up to 3 hours to get to the hospital. So, you know, I've always found that connecting with your patient is one of the best treatments you can do. And you're kind of giving them that healing power of hope. And then I love meeting new people and you hear great stories. So that's one part of the job I love as much as, you know, starting an IV or doing other things.
Sometimes the patient you're looking for is somebody not even in sight. Maybe they're lost. You've got to go looking for them before you even get there. We're going to talk about one such instance. We are visiting with Kevin Grange. He is author of Wild Rescues, A Paramedic's Extreme Adventures in Yosemite, Yellowstone, and Grand Teton. This is Constant Wonder. This is Constant Wonder. I'm Marcus Smith. With us, Kevin Grange. He's author of Wild Rescues, A Paramedic's Extreme Adventures in Yosemite, Yellowstone, and Grand Teton. Kevin, when somebody goes missing, before you can even administer any kind of medicine, you got to find the person. And I did allude earlier to a story of a young fellow who went missing in the Uintas and was never found. And that does happen sometimes. You have a happier story than that to tell.
I do, yeah. Yosemite probably has the most search and rescues of any national park. And I think part of that is because it's near the city centers of, you know, San Francisco, Sacramento. So when I was working there as a paramedic, a young man named Alex was missing for 2 days. And, you know, it was winter in California, so it's not as cold as Utah and other parts, but a cold rain had come in and some lightning. So definitely the weather was bad enough to make someone hypothermic. And, you know, we try to tell visitors to leave their itinerary in their car. So then if they are ever missing, we can see that itinerary in the dashboard and know exactly where to look for them. However, unfortunately, we didn't have Alex's itinerary. And so then it's just kind of a process of, you know, interviewing his friends and trying to piece together what he might have been thinking when he started that hike. So anyways, he was missing for about 2 days. And with each passing day, with each passing hour, you kind of start to worry that, hey, is this going to be a search and rescue or actually more of like a recovery mission, you know, with a body? But against all odds, we found him 2 days later, and he was kind of initially alert. But as we got him into the ambulance and the heated ambulance, and he became less and less alert, and his vital signs really started crashing, which is really interesting to me. And kind of what I learned from that call is a lot of times when someone's missing, they have that fight or flight response. So their sympathetic nervous system's kicked in. And then when the rescuers appear, you would think, hey, he's just going to get better. But oftentimes there's that release. So sort of the patient gives up at that moment and, you know, the vessels begin to dilate, the blood pressure drops. So it's actually one of the most dangerous moments of a rescue is when we arrive. So having learned that, whenever I arrive on a search and rescue these days, the first thing I say is, you know, we're here, the worst is over, but you got to keep fighting with us. You know, don't give up now. And that tends to keep the patient engaged in their own care.
Is this the kind of thing that you learn from other people with more experience? I mean, did you know that this was a critical moment when you find somebody who's been missing? Or is, I guess it's just kind of on the job training, but somebody had to tell you that.
Definitely. I think anyone in any profession, certainly pre-hospital medicine, just learning to pick the right mentors is huge. And so I've been lucky enough to work with some amazing park rangers and paramedics, and I was just like a sponge soaking in as much as I could. On this particular case, the learning curve was more watching it happen. And then we always debrief after a call. So we talk about, you know, what we could improve upon and lessons learned. And a physician assistant I was working with, you know, he kind of explained what went on with Alex. And, you know, this story does have a happy ending. Even though he did sort of crash when we got there, we, you know, administered some fluid and heated him up. And we rendezvoused with the helicopter, who ultimately, you know, put a breathing tube in his windpipe and flew him to the closest trauma center. And then, you know, he was out probably a couple of weeks later and is doing well. So that's, you know, a very happy ending to that story.
A lot of people in the caring professions do their service. They help people. Those people then disappear. Do you ever have follow-up?
It's rare. We don't expect it, but again, at Yellowstone, I had a woman who, there's an ice rink in Yosemite. There's an ice rink in Yosemite Valley, and we'd often have people fall and hit their heads, and she ended up having a, you know, life-threatening epidural brain bleed, and you know, it's traumatic for the first responder as much as it is for the patient, because even though we meet them briefly, we do really care about every patient we treat. So many times you don't know what the outcome is, but a couple weeks later, she showed up with a gift basket, and she stopped back into Yosemite and said hello. And that was just amazing closure, you know, for her and for me and my team. And I think we were all just kind of crying at that moment, just celebrating, you know, the success of the rescue and her recovery. And, you know, it was a beautiful moment.
Yeah. Well, I want to go back to Alex's story just for a minute, because I have this question. If you've been looking for 2 days for somebody and you know it might be a body recovery, and then all of a sudden there's word that somebody's been found, does that adrenalize you? Do you suddenly – what do you experience in that moment? I know that suddenly it's like there's work to be done now. We've got to administer this aid. But I'm wondering if suddenly you get supercharged with a little bit of adrenaline.
You do, definitely. And I think it's sort of that adrenaline of hope that, hey, we can save this life. And, you know, the interesting thing is a lot of times on the missing person posters, it's them, you know, at their senior picture, or so they're always looking healthy and smiling on the missing person photos. But then when you actually find them and they've been through this traumatic incident, you know, they look oftentimes very different. But, you know, there is that adrenaline like you're talking about, and we just jump right into, you know, gear and do everything we can to save their life.
You have a Yellowstone story about trying to transform a terrible day into a good family memory. And this has to do with the kid with the broken arm. I just am amazed that you would have the emotional kind of insight into thinking, not only am I trying to deal with a broken arm here, but this is going to be a family memory. And I want to make it a good one.
Yeah, definitely. I grew up camping with my family, and my favorite childhood memories are all of us in the tent, you know, exploring the White Mountains of New Hampshire and Acadia National Park. So I've grown up knowing that, hey, these are special moments with families and friends. And when the accident happens or the illness, it's sort of this jarring intruder upon, you know, someone's vacation. And so the call you're talking about was this young girl who fell and broke her arm. And, you know, it's when you're that age, it's scary and there's pain. And I just kind of knew that, you know, I didn't want her to associate national parks and camping and hiking with this painful memory. So after I splinted her arm and gave her some pain medication, I really just focused on connecting with her and her mom and, you know, just trying to transform this traumatic incident to one of growth. And maybe, you know, they started to have a sense of humor about it. And by the end of it, you know, they were taking pictures in the ambulance, and it was something that she had overcome. So it wasn't just this bad incident. It was more like, hey, she did this, and, you know, she's a big girl. And so it became a great sort of bonding moment for all of us.
What kind of words did you have at your disposal? What tricks up your sleeve to kind of bring the whole thing into a context of a good memory? I don't even know what I would say.
Well, I really try to like speak with my patients and find out, you know, where they're from and what they're interested in. And you hear all kinds of interesting stories from, you know, former professional football players to it turns out there's a cornhole champion, you know, the game where you throw like those bean bags. So I met the cornhole champion. So who knew? So with this young girl, you know, she loved gymnastics. So I'm trying to redirect the scene and her attention away from her broken arm. And so we talked about gymnastics, and then, you know, she and her mom showed me some photos, and it took all her attention away from the arm. And, you know, once we stopped talking about that, you know, I think we saw a moose, you know, driving through Tetons, and, you know, so just redirecting them and then kind of getting them past the initial incident.
It was her love of gymnastics, no doubt, that got her into trouble in the first place. I understand, was she trying to balance on an old fallen tree?
Yep, exactly. So, but yeah, they had a good laugh about that. And, you know, I was able to kind of control her pain with some pain medication. And yeah, ultimately it was sort of not a story of a bad day in Yellowstone, but a story of like her, you know, being courageous and brave and overcoming this. And I think she felt really proud that she was able to do that.
Well, Kevin, a conversation like this would be incomplete if we didn't do something in the way of imparting wisdom for somebody going to the national parks. And I've been able to see some implicit wisdom already, the idea that you're not just going on vacation, but you're also not going on vacation for your medications, your regimens.
Sure.
But what else could you offer that would help people have a better experience and not get into trouble?
You know, these days with COVID, it's really driven people to the outdoors, which I love, but I think people need to plan more in advance, you know, to make sure they have a campsite set up and whatnot. And then if you're going for a hike, I definitely recommend taking the 10 essentials of hiking, which you can find online, you know, like a map and extra water, extra food, sunscreen, all that kind of stuff. And then again, like I mentioned, leave your itinerary in the dashboard of your car. That's another great idea. You know, no selfies with the bison. Just remember that, you know, wildlife is wild. And then I think there's different types of park rangers. So there's law enforcement park rangers. There's park rangers that lead interpretation talks. So I would just say get involved with the national park. And, you know, there's a great junior ranger program. So there's so much there, you know, beyond the hiking. So just take it all in and enjoy it. And, you know, hopefully visit as many national parks as you can.
Well, the way you tell your story, this is more than just a book about a paramedic who has a job in the national parks. This was life-changing for you. And you make a big point out of this. This was a pivotal moment when you landed this kind of a job. And given the fact that it was life-changing for you, have you got some wrong metaphor to say fire in your bones, because there's too much fire these days, but are you still good? Are you good for a whole lot of more wild rescues?
I am, yeah. As you mentioned, it was life-changing. And, you know, previously I was looking for jobs in cities, but having this experience with the Park Service, I kind of reconnected, which was what was ultimately important to me, which was, you know, nature, the outdoors, travel. So it's life-changing in that regard. And then on the professional side, I just love the challenge of remote and rural medicine, you know, whether it's locating the patient or the transport times to the hospital. And you really get autonomy and to really use the full scope of your medicine, you know, because you do have that extended transport time with the patients. And again, that's just another time to connect with them. And yeah, so I love it out here. And I think I'll be in Jackson Hole, you know, for the duration of my career.
Kevin Grange, it's been just great to have a chance to visit with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you. I've had so much fun and hope to see everyone out here in Yellowstone and Grand Teton soon.
Kevin Grange with us. He's author of Wild Rescues, A Paramedic's Extreme Adventures in Yosemite, Yellowstone, and Grand Teton. I'm Marcus Smith. A pleasure to be with you. This hour on Constant Wonder, we have been in the national parks, great institutions, and with actually surprising origins. Not very long ago, I had the pleasure of speaking with Tom Rust, a professor of history at Montana State University, Billings. Rust is author of Watching Over Yellowstone, The U.S. Army's Experience in America's First National Park, 1886 to 1918.
The soldiers didn't always want to be there. This wasn't exactly, you know, the riding to glory that they envisioned when they signed up for the Army. I mean, here they are, you know, fighting tourists and, you know, concessionaires.
Stop. Fighting tourists. the U.S. government is not supposed to send armies after its own people. You know that.
Yes, there's kind of this, I think, this awkward tension, because coming out in the context of the time, just before the Army was asked to come into the park in 1886, the use of the Army as a police force was very controversial. You got to realize you're only 9 years out from Reconstruction. And particularly Southern Democrats have a very bitter taste in their mouth regarding the Army enforcing, you know, civilian law and being the, you know, basically the police force of the land. Then you also have, you know, a number of labor disputes and unrest that's happening. You know, the most famous, you know, where the Army gets kind of almost directly involved is the Great Railway Strike of 1877. And again, the Army is brought in and on the side of capital or the business owners, the railroad, and against the striking workers. So Northern Democrats certainly have issues with it as well. So certainly the Democratic Party was a little bit uncomfortable with that. And a lot of people, you know, this was not very comfortable. And the Army wasn't real thrilled about it either, because this isn't what soldiering is about, you know. And today it's kind of, you know, we have this idea of nation building. You know, we go into countries and, you know, after a conflict, and then we have to nation build, and the police or the Army provides these policing type functions. But, you know, when you go back into the late, you know, 19th century, that's, you know, that issue is not very good. And so there was a law passed called the Posse Comitatus Act that said armies can't do that. And the officers are like, thank goodness, because we don't like, you know, how that confuses our duties and, you know, what we do and, you know, get involved in these local disputes. But, you know, for the most part, we kind of accepted now, and even before they'd kind of accepted in the West, you know, the Army could at times perform policing duties out here in the West where there wasn't a large federal presence. But in the late 19th century, that was actually quite controversial.
Yeah, well, I could tell you stories about the Utah War where the Army came
well,
to police.
That too, yeah.
Yeah. Well, I'm still scratching my head here. I'm just wondering, what were they thinking in Washington, D.C.? I'm not the first person to ask that question, by the way. But are they saying, OK, we've got grizzlies, we've got geysers, and we've got tourists, and we better send the Army to watch out for those tourists?
Not so much, actually. The biggest debate was, what do you do with this national park? It's created in 1872 with no infrastructure. It's like, hey, it'd be great if we had this park. And part of the impetus for this was the railroads are thinking, hey, we could really, as the West is, you know, the Wild West is kind of, you know, winding down. They could even kind of feel that, you know, we got to get people on trains, and what better way than to bring them out and show them this great wonder. And, you know, Yosemite had predated it. The U.S. government gave the land for Yosemite to the state of California to make into a park. But Yellowstone was a little bit different because it's mostly in Wyoming. The political powers, however, that really wanted it to be a park are the Northern Pacific Railroad, which is going through Montana, and the politicians in Montana are falling in line. And the easiest way to get into the park even then, and it wasn't easy really, but the easiest way to get in was from the north. And so the Montanans are really the ones pushing it, but most of it was in Wyoming. So someone came up with this grand idea that, hey, well, if you can't be in Montana, because it's always been really quite a bit more important in its early history to Montana than it was to Wyoming, well, let's condemn it, we'll make it a national park. But making it a park and then administering it are two entirely different things. And so you have this very large, powerful economic interest in the railroads that, you know, pushed and created for this park, who want to exploit it for their own benefits, quite literally. And so we start, you know, having these companies, and the railroads make these subsidiary companies that are what we now call concessionaires, basically. They put up hotels and all this, and it's a kind of a package deal, and the railroads are bringing people in. But what are the rules? Okay, so they make this law in 1872 for the enjoyment and benefit of the people, and it's all, you know, this kind of fancy language, much like, you know, say, the Declaration of Independence. But just like the Declaration of Independence, there's nothing about how you're going to rule it. I mean, it's you know, this ideological statement. The law in 1872 is an ideological statement, but what are the rules? What does it mean? How who gets to operate, and how do they get to use or perhaps abuse the park, and where's the line on that? And so these companies come in, and it becomes a big debate about how much land, how big their operation should be, how much land they should be given to, you know, create buildings, or, you know, cut down trees to build these buildings in the wilderness and build roads and those kinds of things. So, you know, there are some people that very much were abusing it. And then the railroad actually gets involved, and they want to lay tracks into the park, which would, in many people's minds, especially when you talk to people like John Muir and things like that, having these steam engines with their coal just, you know, being burned and all that, the noise and all that, that would, you know, destroy the idea of the park. And so there's exploitation going on from these very strong capitalist forces. Then if you want to go to the locals around the park, also exploited the park because it was a very rich hunting and trapping ground. And so they're in there hunting, they're trapping, and there's pictures of, there's one in particular that I think is very telling. Just outside the park, there's this railroad station with carcass after carcass after carcass of elk. And there's these people just sitting around very proud of the harvesting of these animals that they've done. You know, there's even a little kid in the front holding this gun that's bigger than himself. And so those local people had been depending upon the food that was there. Now, some people had been harvesting food to, you know, feed the mining settlement, particularly out west, but particularly Butte, Montana. But others had been doing it, you know, for elk ivories, you know, to get the elk teeth that were extraordinarily valuable. Bison heads were very valuable. So there was kind of a capitalist hunting that was going on, but then there was also a subsistence. The local people around very much, you know, were used to using that park. Now, can you continue to do that? Because there's really no regulations, but if you hunt it too much, it becomes a problem. And as government officials were going through the park, particularly Lieutenant General Philip Sheridan, he loved Yellowstone. He traveled through it many times. In fact, he took President Arthur through at one point, and he was shocked by how much hunting there was in the park, and he began to publicize that, and he began to criticize that, and he began to try to draw attention to it. Other people were shocked by the amount of capitalism and exploitation that was going on, and they were concerned that if there was no regulation or no enforcement to rein in those capitalistic forces, it's going to end up like Niagara Falls, which at that time became like the epitome of a tourist trap. Everywhere there was, you know, a hotel or something kind of around the falls, and it was, you know, just this kind of generally capitalistic heaven, but on the other hand, kind of aesthetically ugly type thing. And people were concerned that that was going to happen in Yellowstone. So there became an awareness that these forces, it wasn't so much protecting the tourists that are coming through as much as the park could be destroyed if there was not some sort of regulation to kind of rein these forces in. The big problem was is that to regulate it, you would have to have people, and to have people and infrastructure to regulate it, you'd have to have money. And there was a big debate about whether or not you should devote money to this. And it became a very hot political issue.
Tell us about some people here, some of the soldiers who there are not out and out skirmishes, but there are brawls and there's conflicts with the poachers. Let's start with a poacher, Ed Howell. What do you know about Ed Howell?
So Ed Howell was one of those guys that just thought it was kind of his right to be able to go in the park and hunt animals that he would use for primarily buffalo, because buffalo heads became very vogue to have, and if you could have one, they fetched a really good price. So he would go into the park, hunt buffalo, coming out of Cook City, which is in the northeast corner, just outside the northeast corner of the park, really high up in the mountains and kind of hard to get to. In fact, especially in the winter, the only way to get to Cook City was to go through the park itself. But he would come into the park, hunt the buffalo, cut off their heads, get them taxidermied, and then he could sell them for a very large profit. Well, once the army came in, even still, it was kind of a very disorganized when the army came in. Yeah, they know they're supposed to prevent hunting. They knew they were there, but they had no punishments for people. So when, you know, people would violate the laws, they couldn't literally put them in jail at all. They could only kick them out of the park. But the army came up with some kind of creative solutions about things that, you know, if someone was carved their name in a feature, well, the army would look at that name, and then they would go through the hotel registries and they'd find the person, and they would wait for the person to leave the park. Then they would arrest that person, make them go back to where they'd carved their names in the feature and then scrub it off. And so literally under guard would make them do that as kind of their punishment, because they couldn't put them in jail or fine them or anything like that. Even poachers, you know, before Ed Howell, there was really very little punishments that you could do other than kick the people out of the park. So oftentimes when they would catch a poacher, they would confiscate all their goods and move it to one end of the park and then march the poacher out of the park at the other end of the park. So they would be separated by, you know, hundreds of miles of wilderness, right? So, yeah, the army kind of was operating, you know, in a you know, kind of ad hoc fashion about how you deal with this, because even the laws after the army got there weren't well set down. So Ed Howell's one of these poachers, and, you know, he's played this cat and mouse game. It's almost like guerrilla warfare, because poachers would do these. They'd go out and they would play these games with the soldiers, and kind of these hit and run, you know, and they would try to draw the soldiers out and things. And so poachers would go in one place, they'd fire their gun into the air, and then they would hide in the bushes and wait to see if any soldiers came out and where they were. And so then they could go to a place where the soldiers were, because it's a huge wilderness, even with the army patrolling it. There's a lot of open territory there. But Ed Howell is kind of particularly daring, because he's going to go into the winter. And Yellowstone in the winter is, man, it's a beast. All right. There's no two ways around it. It's a beast. But, you know, the incentive for him to do it is obviously great enough to do that. So he goes off and he's hunting, and the U.S. Army, led by one of its scouts, a guy by the name Burgess, they look in and they see Howell in the middle of this field. They heard the shots and they found him, and they decided that they're going to try to arrest this guy. Now, he had a dog with him, which is it was supposed to, you know, provide warning of anybody approaching, but they literally caught Hal red-handed because he'd shot the bison. He was dressing him. His hands are covered in blood. He's busy working. The dog apparently is not paying attention. And so the scout decides to go off and make a run across this open field. Now, this is kind of a dangerous deal because, you know, Burgess has got a gun, and he could easily, with this guy running across an open field with no cover, you know, he could easily get shot. But he thinks that he can make it before Burgess will see him. So he waits till Burgess is particularly deep in dressing his animals, and he starts making his way across. Now, the soldiers that were with him provided cover from the tree line. But, you know, he's running across this open snowy field, and then there's a big dip that he hadn't saw before, and he has to jump across that dip. I mean, a very dramatic episode. And he gets up on Burgess before the dog can make a noise, and he gets the draw on Burgess on Howell and arrests him. And this becomes incredibly important because after they arrest him, and Hal is very upset with his dog, and you know, wants to shoot him, but you know, they stop him from shooting his dog and stuff. But they begin to march him out of the park. And as they're coming out of the park, there's a reporter that was skiing with another group and making kind of a photo report of Yellowstone. And he's from... Now it's Field and Stream is what I want to call it, but I might have that wrong. But he's going out, and this reporter sees him and captures a picture, a very famous picture, and then writes a whole report about this. And he quickly gets it off because he recognized a good story when he saw it. And so he got this off, and he kind of ends the story by saying, you know, this guy clearly, and they show buffalo heads and all this, and you know, he had literally caught red-handed, buffalo skulls, hunting, all that. But nothing's really going to happen to this guy because there is no law to enforce the rule of no hunting. And so the most that'll happen is he'll get kicked out of the park. Well, it gets published. And once it gets published, very quickly it becomes kind of a mini, you know, political uproar, particularly in the halls of Congress. And within a few weeks, suddenly there's laws. Hey, if you're poaching in the park, you're going to be put in jail. And so the Army now suddenly starts to get some more guidance as to exactly what they can do, can't do, and how to go about carrying out their duties, and have a little bit of teeth to it. And finally, there's a judge, John Meldrum, who's brought in that presides over court cases, so the Army can arrest people. They're brought before a judge in the park, which still there's a judge in the park today, and a court system in the park, so that you can be tried there, and your punishment can be met out. And so the legal apparatus begins to take full thanks to some of the soldiers' actions, to be sure.
But the soldiers got bored themselves, and they understand they did a little poaching of their own.
Well, yeah. I mean, come on. I mean, of course you're gonna, you know, you're around all this game, and it's part of American culture. Whatever you feel about guns and hunting on your own. I mean, it was part of American culture, the kind of that frontier element of it. And when we look at the poaching that happens by the soldiers, they're doing the kind of the two types of poaching I talked about earlier. I mean, there's the commercial, and there was rumors, nothing actually as concrete as that I could find, but there were certainly rumors that some soldiers were hunting for the elk ivories. But when we look at the archaeology of some of the soldier stations, because in the park itself, there's the main fort at Mammoth, and then there's several kind of remote stations for just the soldiers with no officers, or at least regularly having officers there. It's just the soldiers by themselves. When we look at the archaeology of some of those remote soldier stations, there is a substantial number of bones that indicate that the soldiers were hunting and eating the local game. Now, this type of poaching, this kind of subsistence poaching, is a little, very strong and a little bit more understandable, I think, because one, you know, Army rations probably were getting a little old, and you know, to have some fresh meat is certainly nice. And there's all this game around, and when you do this, and this is again another American tradition that dates way back, what Carl Jacoby calls moral ecology, that rather than having government regulations determine, you know, what hunting regulations should be, you should leave it to the people, who on their own will determine how much hunting is appropriate, because they don't want to destroy the game themselves. They, however, need the to find a form of subsistence from the environment as well. And as the 19th century and into the 20th century progresses, and there's more government regulations, oftentimes, you know, kind of the common guy pushes against that. And he goes into great detail about that back in the Adirondacks and but also out here. And he does a little bit on Yellowstone, too, and touches on some of that, too, that the subsistence form of hunting was very much an American tradition. And so it would be actually, I think, more surprising if the soldiers didn't engage in that
while they were stationed
in the park than if they didn't. I would be much more surprised if they didn't. And they're, you know, and we see this not only in the archaeology, but in the pictures, they've got elk antlers hanging around their trophies. And there's one really great source of a sergeant who's going on just before winter is going to set in. He's going and inspecting the some of these soldier outposts, and they're pretty unabashed about it. I mean, he's like, "Yeah, we had a good venison dinner here. You know, this is good stuff. You know, this guy really knows how to cook." And it was very, very clear. That soldiers were engaged in this type of activity, and even though it was officially against the regulations, and there are times it's a 30-year period we're talking about here. There are some that were court-martialed for it, but I also think that a number of commanders were probably a little bit more forgiving of it because they would be, you know, they understood the situation, and as long as it didn't get out of hand. It probably was a sin they could live with, so to speak.
Yeah. Well, I love the outdoors, Tom, and I have never spent a long winter in some small hut or cabin in Yellowstone, so I shouldn't be speaking here at all. But I can imagine, from a modern perspective, that who wouldn't want to be assigned to Yellowstone? And yet there were soldiers who were miserable there, didn't want to be stationed there. They were either itching for action abroad or just wanted to escape the boredom of the place for them. There were desertions aplenty.
Yeah, and that was especially around 1908, there was this rash of desertions. In fact, it had one of the highest desertion rates in the entire army, so much so that they created this, and they had to have this investigation. So the inspector general started asking questions of the commanders, and the commander said, "Oh, well, it was the poor recruits, those bad recruits that you guys are sending us. Well, that's why we're having such a high desertion rate." You know, the inspector general was like, "I'm not buying that." So they actually conducted an investigation, and that was one of the real gems I found when I was going through the records in the National Archives was this inspection report, and I was like, "Wow, this is huge." And it resonated with me to a certain degree because, you know, having grown up in and around the park, when I started working there and I was, you know, overseeing employees, I had several employees under me, but also one of my jobs. And for a while, before I was controller at Bridge Bay, I spent a year as assistant controller at Lake Lodge, and a number of employees quit. You know, they just like, they can't handle this, and they quit. And I was like, "What? What are you talking about? You're going to quit Yellowstone? Are you crazy?" But, you know, then I started to, you know, my naivete wore off, and I started realizing, you know, everybody has a different reaction to Yellowstone. And for some person, there was one guy from New York who's like, "Man, I just can't handle how quiet it is here." Well, to me, it's not quiet because, you know, I can hear the birds and the wind through the trees and all. But, you know, he's used to cars and sirens and you know, all that, and horns honking. And so it's such a different experience for someone from a deeply urban environment to come to such a rural place that is even still very isolated. Well, so when I start seeing this, I'm like, "Oh, yeah, this makes sense." You know, it wasn't much different for some of these guys. And so when going through that investigation that they did, it was very telling because it also pushed it, some of my research in different directions as well, because the number of things: one, the isolation, the winter, the boredom, you know, and it wasn't what they signed up for. That was all present. But one of the things that really came through very clearly was a phrase that they decided: the disrespect shown to the uniform. That a number of soldiers did not like how tourists treated them. Soldiers, particularly in the late 19th century, were oftentimes perceived as being from a lower class. They were, and class structure and class identity was much stronger than obviously today. And right up to World War One, you know, at World War One, we start to see that weakening a little bit. Victorian class structure was very much a thing. And the tourists who are going to Yellowstone, who can afford to take the time off to take, you know, a week on the train to come out to Yellowstone, and another week through the park, and a week home. You know, those are wealthy people. They tend to be wealthy. And that was explicitly who the railroads and the hotel companies were advertising to and catering to. And so you have this real interesting dynamic of these people who perceive themselves as socially superior visiting this park, paying a lot of money to do it. And then you have these soldiers who they perceive as their social inferiors, but legally have authority over them. And it creates a real tense dynamic that plays out in several cases where, and the soldiers, again, they're not necessarily trained as policemen anyway, and so they're following their orders, and they're, you know, sometimes they're going to enforce it to the letter of the law. You know, someone who feels that they're socially superior to someone is being told by their perceived inferior to do something, or then there's kind of a little bit of interesting dynamic and confrontation that goes on there, and there's several cases of that. That social atmosphere and the way that the tourists were treating the soldiers was so uncomfortable that none of them just had enough, and they decided they were going to get out of Dodge, and so they left.
That was part of my conversation with Tom Rust. Rust is a professor of history at Montana State University in Billings. He's author of Watching Over Yellowstone, the U.S. Army's Experience in America's First National Park, 1886 to 1918. We are headed for a Civil War story, entirely new to me, actually. I don't know about you, but I've never been to Richmond, Virginia. I understand there's a historic site there of considerable importance, but all that Richmond today has to show for it is a small identifying plaque. I'm talking about the site of the notorious Libby Prison, where by 1863, during the Civil War, over 1,000 Union inmates were incarcerated. We have for you a thrilling prison escape story. It involves tunnels, sewers, daring escapades under cover of darkness, and a Grand Southern Belle turned Union spy. A couple of characters in the story, Thomas Rose and Andrew Hamilton, they plan their escape from the Confederacy's most infamous prison, the compound called the Libby Prison. And they know it's their only hope for surviving. Conditions are so terrible there. The story coming up, I'm Marcus Smith, and this is Constant Wonder.